Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit is now open according to law. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning. This is Judge Wilson in Tampa. Judge Martin is in Atlanta. And Judge Jordan is in Miami. And we're here for oral argument in Matthew Reeves versus the Alabama Department of Corrections. And Benjamin Isaac Friedman is here for Appellant Reeves. Beth Jackson Hughes is here for the Commissioner of the Alabama Department of Corrections. And counsel, you have 30 minutes per side. I understand that Mr. Friedman has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. And Mr. Thomas, the courtroom deputy, is the timekeeper. And he will let you know when your time for argument has expired. And he will also give you a two-minute warning when there are 2 minutes left in your argument. So we're ready to proceed in this case. And we'll hear from Mr. Friedman. Mr. Friedman, are you ready to present your argument on behalf of Appellant Reeves?
I am, Your Honor. Thank you so much for having us under these circumstances. May it please the court, my name is Ben Friedman and I represent petitioner appellant Matthew Reeves. In this appeal, Reeves raises two claims: that he's intellectually disabled under Atkins and Hall, and therefore the Eighth Amendment prohibits his execution. And second, he received the ineffective assistance of counsel during the penalty phase of his trial. I'm going to start with the Atkins claim this morning. Mr. Reeves' Atkins claim is unique in that the evidence offered by experts for both Reeves and the state established that Reeves is intellectually disabled and the Constitution prohibits his execution. Both experts agreed that Matthew Reeves has an IQ of approximately 70, and the state's expert concluded that Reeves has an IQ of 68. That's well below the 70 cutoff courts typically use to determine whether someone has significantly subaverage intellectual functioning. And both experts agreed that the objective test results showed Matthew Reeves has significant adaptive deficits in at least three areas, one more than necessary to satisfy the criteria for intellectual disability. And both experts agreed that Matthew Reeves' intellectual functioning has not changed since he was a child. If Reeves is intellectually disabled now, his disability manifested itself before he turned 18. On this record, the only reasonable conclusion is that Matthew Reeves is intellectually disabled under Atkins and Hall. In fact, state has not pointed to a single case, and I'm not aware of any, where a court has ever rejected an intellectual disability claim on similar facts. Where the state's expert...
Counsel, this is Judge Wilson. Let's assume that the Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals unreasonably applied Atkins and Hall by holding that he did not meet the intellectual functioning prong. I'm more concerned about the adaptive functioning prong. It looks to me like the court there, the state court, weighed the evidence of the two experts and decided to rely on Dr. King's assessment. And Dr. King gave his opinion that Reeves did not have significant or substantial deficits in his adaptive functioning. Given that determination, how do we disturb the state court's conclusion that Reeves did not satisfy the adaptive functioning prong?
Your Honor, your question assumes that the court would find the Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals decision unreasonably applied to Hall and Atkins on the first prong. And if the court does that, then this court's review becomes de novo. So at that point, once the AEDPA deference is stripped off the CCA's opinion, this court would then be free to analyze the evidence de novo. And under a de novo standard, I don't think there's really any doubt that Reeves would satisfy the adaptive deficits prong. It's only when this court applies deference where you run into this situation that I think Your Honor is after, which is that the court reasonably weighed the evidence and then reached a conclusion. And what I'll say on that prong, so or on that part, rather, is that even if this court were just to look at the adaptive deficits prong under the AEDPA standard, there was still a misapplication of Hall, and there was still an unreasonable determination of facts, and here's why. Under the Alabama definition of intellectual disability, Reeves had to establish that he had adaptive deficits in at least three areas. That's exactly what Dr. King found. He administered an adaptive functioning test, and we don't concede that that test was appropriate, because it certainly wasn't, and the evidence is very clear on that. That test was normed against the developmentally disabled population, whereas the AAMR definition at the time required the use of a test that was normed against the general population. But putting that issue to the side, Your Honor, using those test results, that would have conclusively established that Matthew Reeves has adaptive deficits. And further, Dr. King even considered the evidence that the Court of Criminal Appeals said it considered in rejecting that conclusion. So, for example, if you look at Dr. King's report, he says that he considered the fact that Reeves had been incarcerated for most of his life and that Reeves had confessed to being a drug dealer. But he said, even considering those facts, Matthew Reeves has some adaptive deficits in the areas of domestic activity, vocational activity, and self-direction, which still placed him below average relative to the developmentally disabled population. So what does that mean? That means that even with the facts that the Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals relied on, Dr. King himself still thought that Reeves had adaptive deficits that put him below the 50% mark of intellectually disabled people. That is more than enough to show that he met the second criteria of the intellectual disability test, and the Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals decision is an unreasonable determination of fact based on that alone.
Mr. Friedman, this is Judge Jordan. Could I ask you a question in that respect, please?
Of course, Your Honor.
Didn't the Court of Criminal Appeals say that there was evidence in the record that called into question the validity of some of the test scores? And didn't it then go on to analyze that evidence to determine the adaptive deficits prong?
The answer to your question, Your Honor, is yes, the court did say that there was some evidence that called into question the validity of the results. But what I'm trying to say, Your Honor, is that Dr. King actually considered that evidence when he scored the test. So Dr. King considered the fact that Matthew Reeves didn't necessarily have an opportunity to develop adaptive skills in certain areas, and he still concluded that Matthew Reeves fell below the 50% mark when compared against people with developmental disabilities. So it is correct, Your Honor, that there was some evidence in the record that the Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals said undermined that result, but I don't think that's actually factually correct on this record. So if you want to go through the other evidence that the Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals cited, they cited the fact, for example, that Matthew Reeves had obtained job certificates in welding and auto mechanics, but there's no evidence that he ever actually put those skills to use, and there's no evidence that a developmentally disabled person like Matthew Reeves couldn't have obtained those types of certificates. So, and I think the same is true of the other evidence the court cited. For instance, the court cited the circumstances of Matthew Reeves' crime. And as horrible as those circumstances are, Your Honor, they don't actually display any level of sophistication. There was no advanced planning. Mr. Reeves did not take any steps to conceal his crime necessarily. So this is a crime that was essentially solved within 24 hours of when it was committed. Mr. Reeves committed the crime in an alley behind his house. He left a trail of blood that led to his home. He hid the bloodstained clothes of him, his bloodstained clothes and his co-conspirators in his room, along with the murder weapon. He continued to wear a bloodstained jacket throughout the evening. And when the police came to arrest him, he still had that jacket in his possession. So this is not a crime that, that required a level of sophistication. There's nothing in the record that actually supports that.
One more question on that score. Neither Atkins nor Hall say anything about how to apply the second prong of adaptive deficits, right?
Your Honor, I don't agree with that. I think that Hall is very clear that with respect to both prongs of the intellectual disability test, the courts must apply the medical community's diagnostic framework. And that applies to both the first prong and the second prong. So, and that's very clear when you look at Moore, which is just an application of Hall. Moore considered adaptive deficits, and it said, based on Hall's holding, that the medical community's diagnostic framework, not controls, but is informative on the question of the legal definition of intellectual disability, that the court unreasonably weighed adaptive strengths against adaptive deficits. So I don't think it's accurate to say that Hall says nothing about the adaptive deficits prong. It certainly does.
But here, didn't the Court of Criminal Appeals consider adaptive deficits by relying on evidence calling into question the test results that showed Mr. Reeves had significant adaptive deficits?
Your Honor, I think I missed the first part of your question, so I'm not sure I got the whole thing. But
I'll be happy to repeat it. Didn't the Court of Criminal Appeals consider possible adaptive deficits?
Yes, Your Honor, it did consider possible adaptive deficits, but it started at the wrong place. So what the Court of Criminal Appeals did is it started with Dr. King's results from the ABS test. That test is not normed against the general population, and the AAMR says that that test shouldn't be used to diagnose intellectual disability. So it started there, and then it looked at the three areas that Dr. King found Reeves had significant adaptive deficits, and it went through the evidence that called into question those three findings. But there's no evidence that even considering that evidence, even Dr. King would have thought Matthew Reeves performed more than 50% or better than 50% of people with developmental disabilities. And that's exactly the problem. There's just no evidence to support the idea that the evidence that the court considered actually negated the finding of the objective test results that Reeves has adaptive deficits in at least two areas.
If we could move to the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, which I think is probably your strongest claim. Isn't it clear from the record that Mr. Reeves' trial counsel did conduct some investigation of Reeves' mental capacity and presented mitigating evidence through three witnesses and various documents? And then on post-conviction relief, his attorneys did not testify. So given that background, how do we say that the Alabama court unreasonably applied Strickland versus Washington?
Your Honor, the relevant question here is whether counsel adequately investigated Mr. Reeves' intellectual disability and other mitigating factors. The fact that trial counsel did present some evidence, we know from Wiggins versus Smith, does not preclude a finding that counsel performed effectively. And when it comes to the evidence of counsel's investigation of Reeves' intellectual disability, what we know is that trial counsel admitted there were red flags in his background that required further investigation. We know that trial counsel admitted that they weren't capable of adequately investigating that evidence. They admitted that hiring an expert was the only way to properly investigate that evidence, and then trial counsel admitted that waiting until the penalty phase was too late. So the fact that counsel did present three witnesses, none of those witnesses testified about intellectual disability, and that's the critical problem. And once trial counsel throws up their hands and says, I'm not capable of investigating the matters at issue, and then goes to the court twice and begs for funds to hire an expert, they have to contact that expert. They have to do more. And that's exactly what the problem is here. The fact that trial counsel...
Mr. Freeman, this is Beverly Martin. If I could just press you on that, setting aside the questions about Dr. Goff for the moment, can you just elaborate on how the mitigating and aggravating circumstances should have been reweighed after the additional mitigation evidence came in the Rule 32 hearing? What are the distinctions you make about what the jury heard as opposed to what they should have heard in terms of mitigation testimony?
Your Honor, the jury heard that Matthew Reeves is not intellectually disabled. That's the first key fact that the jury never heard any evidence about. They heard the opposite. Dr. Ronan testified that Reeves affirmatively was not intellectually disabled, even though she had never performed the appropriate evaluation and tests for that. Second, the jury never heard that Matthew Reeves was beaten almost daily with ropes, with switches, braided switches, extension cords. The jury never heard that Mr. Reeves frequently witnessed domestic violence in his home, that Reeves witnessed, for example, his maternal grandmother attacking his grandfather with a knife, that his maternal grandmother attacked his grandfather with a frying pan, that Reeves witnessed his aunt throwing gasoline in the face of a man and then trying to light a match, or that Reeves' grandmother struck him in the face with a belt buckle. None of that evidence was before the jury. So the question here on Strickland's prejudice prong, of course, is whether there was a reasonable probability of a different outcome. In this particular case, where the jury voted by a vote of 10-2 to recommend death, that's the bare minimum under Alabama law. So Matthew Reeves only had to convince one more juror that a sentence other than death was appropriate, and the evidence of intellectual disability alone could have done that, because the trial court eventually found that Reeves had two mitigating factors, his age at the time of the offense and his lack of significant prior criminal history. It did not find that he was incapable or had a diminished capacity to appreciate his conduct or conform his conduct to law, which is how intellectual disability plays into the mitigating factors. So once you balance that evidence and you compare that to what was presented at the Rule 32, at the original sentencing phase, you get a very different picture about Reeves' life, and that's why there's prejudice here, because it just on the intellectual disability evidence alone, I think you can establish prejudice. But once you consider the other evidence adduced by Dr. Selikin at the Rule 32 proceeding, I think this becomes a very clear case of prejudice. And I'd also like to note, Your Honor, that when it comes to prejudice, the Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals didn't actually decide that issue. And so there's no relevant opinion for what to defer to on this point. So that this court's review of that issue would be de novo in any event.
Could I ask you on the performance side to discuss, if you could, our recent decision in Jenkins, which was also a case in which trial counsel did not testify at the post-conviction hearing?
Your Honor, I think I'm familiar only minimally with Jenkins, and so what I'd say, Your Honor, is I'd be happy to submit a supplemental briefing on that particular case. But from that particular case, I believe, involved circumstances that are very different than what we have here. Here, we actually have trial counsel on the record saying exactly what he thought at various steps of this proceeding. So what we know is that trial counsel had information that required further investigation, and that information was in the nature of neuropsychological and neuropsychiatric information, that and counsel knew that they couldn't adequately investigate that. And so they did what any reasonable lawyer would do, and they went to the court twice and begged for funds to hire an expert to help them. And the court granted those funds. And once it did that, trial counsel was obligated to either contact that expert or do something further. And we know that the reason trial counsel didn't contact Dr. Goff was not because he didn't think expert testimony was necessary or warranted. Trial counsel ended up calling Dr. Ronan at the penalty phase. So we have on the front end, we have trial counsel who affirmatively says on the record multiple times, I need an expert, I can't deal with this information. And then on the back end, we have trial counsel calling an expert but not taking the time to contact that expert in advance of their testimony. That simply cannot be reasonable performance. And this is not a case where the evidence is actually barren. And I think that's really where the Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals decision goes wrong. It says that the record is silent on these issues. And the record is not silent. We have trial counsel's testimony, not testimony, but we have trial counsel's thoughts on the record multiple times over a sustained period of time. So calling trial counsel at the Rule 32 proceeding wouldn't have accomplished anything. We had as close to a confession from trial counsel of error as you can possibly get in this case.
Did the State Circuit Court explain or provide any tactical or strategic reason why Mr. Reeves' counsel might have behaved the way that they did?
Your Honor, I don't believe that the Circuit Court ever provided an explanation, and neither did the Court of Criminal Appeals, and notably the state has never tried to explain why trial counsel did what they did, because there is no explanation here. The only
Is that because Mr. Wiggins was not called to testify on post-conviction relief?
Your Honor, I think it's because there's just no reason why trial counsel would have made the decision that they ended up making. Mm-hmm. And it's notable.
So in other words, we don't know from the record why trial counsel never used Dr. Goff as a neuropsychology expert, even though he had the funds to do so and never contacted him. We don't know from this record why he didn't do that.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. We don't know why, but that doesn't necessarily matter for the Strickland analysis. What Strickland does is
Tell us why we cannot say that the Alabama court unreasonably applied Strickland by finding that it was reasonable to rely on the testimony of Dr. Ronan, who had evaluated Mr. Reeves.
Well,
counsel,
Your Honor,
you have to
Your Honor, it wasn't reasonable to rely on Dr. Ronan because counsel never contacted Dr. Ronan before her testimony because Dr. Ronan hadn't performed an evaluation of Mr. Reeves' intellectual functioning. And so there is no evidence that there was a reasoned decision to rely on Dr. Ronan when Dr. Ronan wasn't contacted until the day of her testimony. That isn't supported by the record because we know that counsel never contacted Dr. Ronan. And for the Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals to assume that decision was reasonable, even though trial counsel didn't contact Dr. Ronan, it is an unreasonable application of Strickland. And it's notable that the Supreme Court in Andrus, just a month or so ago, made exactly the same point. In that case, just like here, trial counsel didn't contact witnesses in advance of their testimony, and the court found that was ineffective. And the same analysis would apply here with respect to the decision about whether trial counsel was reasonable in relying on Dr. Ronan.
I know trial counsel spoke to Dr. Ronan right before or right at the sentencing phase, but when did she evaluate Mr. Reed?
Your Honor, I can't give you a precise date on that, but it was in advance of trial, and the evidence in the record shows that she prepared a report in advance of the sentencing phase.
It was only for the purpose of determining whether he was competent to stand trial? Is that?
That's correct, Your Honor, and okay. I'd like to note that I believe my time is up, but I'm happy to continue answering the question if there's a follow-up.
All right. I think we have your argument, counsel, and we'll hear from Ms. Reeves on behalf of the commissioner.
Thank you, Judge. May it please the court. My name is Beth Hughes, and I represent the state of Alabama in this appeal. I want to first address the intellectual disability claim. Reeves is not entitled to relief on this claim that he is intellectually disabled. The first time Reeves was diagnosed as intellectually disabled was in the state post-conviction proceedings by his own expert. In fact, Reeves was classified his entire life as functioning in the borderline range of intelligence. In this case, the circuit court had to decide whether Reeves met the first prong of the intellectual disability definition, significantly sub-average intellectual functioning, where there was conflicting expert testimony. After considering the conflicting expert testimony, the evidence presented at the Atkins hearing, and record evidence, the circuit court noted that Reeves' intelligence was sub-average, but that it was not significantly sub-average. Thus, as the Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals found, the circuit court resolved the conflicting expert testimony adversely to Reeves. The Court of Criminal Appeals also found there was ample record evidence to support this finding and refused to disturb this holding. This court noted in Clemens, which was decided on July 30th, 2020, that the trier of fact considering the Rule 32 petition, the state court was entitled to make credibility determinations. The state court was entitled to believe Dr. King and discount Dr. Golden's opinion, and that's exactly what happened in this case. The circuit court credited Dr. King's testimony over the testimony of Dr. Goff. And it is not true, as Reeves asserts, that the state's expert, Dr. King, found that Reeves' IQ score of 68 satisfies the first prong of the intellectual disability claim. I want to make clear for the court that Dr. King absolutely found that Mr. Reeves functions in the borderline range of intellectual disability. While he did testify on cross-examination that the 68 score would meet the first prong based strictly on the IQ test he administered, he looked at other evidence to determine Reeves' intellectual functioning. Because after performing the wide-range achievement test, where Reeves was reading and spelling on a fifth-grade level and performing math on a fourth-grade level, Dr. King testified that the scores on this test were higher than ordinarily would be predicted by the IQ test, and that caused him to further explore Reeves' intellectual functioning. Dr. King looked to the following other evidence to determine that Reeves does not suffer from significantly sub-average intellectual functioning. His observation of Reeves, Reeves' performance on other IQ testing, and his review of Reeves' academic records. And the other evidence in the record concerning Reeves' intelligence level includes the following. At 8 years of age, he was estimated to be of low average range by the Cahaba Mental Health Facility. Almost 3 years later, the same facility found that Reed's intelligence level was to be somewhat below average, but not within the intellectual disability range. Reeves was tested for placement into the special education program when he was 11 years old but did not qualify. He was later placed in emotional conflict cases, which are part of the special education program, but was not placed in this program due to his intelligence, but because of his behavioral and emotional issues. In fact, Reeves was never classified as EMR, or educably mentally retarded, by the school system.
What do you say about the argument that the Court of Criminal Appeals evaluated adaptive strengths as opposed to adaptive deficits?
I would disagree with that, Judge. First of all, as this court is aware, and more, the United States Supreme Court, more was decided after this case was completely adjudicated in the state courts. And so more cannot be applied to this case. And that's the United States Supreme Court in Shoup versus Hill so held, and this court in the Clemens case, which was decided on July the 30th of this year, also said that more cannot be applied. I also don't agree that the Court of Criminal Appeals relied on adaptive strengths, because this is exactly what the court said. The Court of Criminal Appeals found that other evidence was presented that either called into question the validity of those scores and or indicated that Reeves' deficits in those areas were not, in fact, significant. So they did not look at – they did not weigh adaptive strengths against adaptive deficits. Instead, they found that there was other evidence that called into question the scores on the adaptive functioning assessments that were conducted by both of the experts. I'd also like to note that in his brief, Mr. Reeves' counsel appears to rely completely on the results of the adaptive functioning assessments conducted by both of the experts. And as the Court of Criminal Appeal noted, nearly all methods of assessing an individual's adaptive functioning, particularly in a retroactive analysis, are imperfect. And the typical approach is to collect information from a multitude of sources to confirm one's conclusions. And that's exactly what happened in this case with Dr. King. For an example of why you shouldn't rely on the results from the experts based entirely on the adaptive functioning test, there are questions about the administration of the ABAS by Dr. Goff. He used Beverly C. Roy as the person to fill out the ABAS, but believed that she was Reeves' stepmother, which she was not. He admitted that Ms. C. Roy guessed on 19 of the 24 areas in the work history part of the test, and he also admitted that she was not really clear on the time period that Reeves lived with her. Finally, she wrote on the test instrument that Reeves appeared to be fairly normal and was a pretty good guy. And the same can be true of the results from Dr. King's administration of the ABS RC2. After scoring this test, Dr. King received other evidence concerning what Mr. Reeves could in fact do. Reeves scored low in the self-directional domain on the ABS, but Dr. King testified that he would have scored Reeves higher had he known that from an early age he had been involved in drug activity and was actually directing the behaviors and activities of others. He also,
I'd like to move to the ineffective assistance of counsel claim.
Yes, sir.
And so I'm trying to figure out why trial counsel never contacted Dr. Goff. Is there an explanation in the record for that when he said initially that he believed that a neuropsychology expert like Dr. Goff was, quote, necessary to compile the hundreds of pages of psychological, psychometric, and behavioral analysis on Reeves and correlate the information and interview the client and present this information in an orderly and informative fashion to the jury during the mitigation phase of the trial?
Yes, sir.
He said he needed it, and he was granted funds for it, but he never contacted Dr. Goff.
Yes, sir.
Do we know from the record why he didn't do that?
We don't know from the record why he did that, but what I can tell you, Judge, is that there was a new attorney, Mr. McLeod, who was the attorney who originally requested these funds, withdrew from the case, and a new attorney, Mr. Goggins, was appointed. And after that point, and appears to be the lead counsel in this case, it's true that Mr. Wiggins was stayed on, but Mr. Goggins appears to have become the lead attorney, and he was a very experienced criminal defense attorney. And so we have a new attorney
Mr. Wiggins would be the one to answer that question, since he was there at the beginning when the funds were requested, right?
That's correct, and he was not called to testify, so we have a silent record on this matter, Judge. And Mr. Reese's attorney seemed to argue to this court just a minute ago that it's the state's burden to show why he didn't appear. Well, it's not the state's burden; it's the defendant's burden in this case to prove why counsel did or did not do anything,
How do we know whether it was a strategic decision or not to contact and call Dr. Goff?
That's a matter of trial strategy. What experts to call and what evidence to present are all matters of trial strategy.
The state can make the argument that was a reasonable strategic decision not to contact Dr. Goff after telling the judge, I need this expert. Can you give me the funds? The court gives him the funds, and he just never contacts Dr. Goff, and instead, during the mitigation phase, uses Dr. Ronan, who didn't even talk to Dr. Ronan until the morning of the beginning of the mitigation phase. The state can say that's reasonable conduct on behalf of trial counsel.
Yes, sir, I think we can, because in this case the record is silent, and I think you have to presume that counsel's conduct was reasonable.
You say that the record is silent, Ms. Hughes, but I don't think that's at all accurate. You have a lawyer who says that there are hundreds of pages that have to be reviewed by an expert. You have a defendant who, even if he is not legally intellectually disabled, certainly is functioning at a relatively low level and is proved to be so by the testimony of both experts later on. So you say that this record is silent, but I don't think it is. It screams out for some level of investigation. And if you could give me, and you say the burden is not on you, and I understand what you're arguing, but could you give me a legitimate strategic reason for not even contacting Dr. Goff?
Yes, sir, I can. They had Dr. Ronan's report. She was an unbiased expert who worked for a state-operated mental health facility, and she conducted a court-ordered evaluation of Reeves. And she would be more credible than an expert hired by the defense. In addition,
Ms. Hughes, this is Beverly Martin. Dr. Ronan was a clinical psychologist, not a neuropsychologist. Isn't that right?
That's correct.
And I understand that when counsel asked the court to fund Dr. Goff, the pitch was a neuropsychologist was, quote, the only avenue open to the defense, end quote. Isn't that what the record reflects?
That's what is reflected in that document, Judge. But, in the actual hearings on the motions for funds and the motions themselves, the thrust of those motions is that they needed somebody to look at all the records and to correlate and come up and to explain the records to counsel, not that they needed him testing for intellectual disability.
Well, wait a minute. Dr. Ronan testified, didn't she, that her evaluation of Mr. Reeves was limited to his competency to stand trial, and she testified about the differences between that analysis and what would have been done by a neuropsychologist.
I'm sorry, Judge Martin. She actually testified that she conducted a complete forensic evaluation on Mr. Reeves, which included a clinical interview, a mental status exam, and then she did the verbal portion of the WAIS to look at his intellectual functioning. And it's true that she was.
And, I mean, I can look back at the record because, you know, we all have it, but my understanding was from her testimony that was, you know, she testified there are different components necessary for the neuropsychological evaluation than what she did.
And that's correct. I mean, but she did do a complete forensic evaluation. It's not true that she just looked at his competence to stand trial. She did look at everything that's done in a normal forensic evaluation of a defendant. And I do want to add here that in this case, the attorneys did do an extensive investigation, and the records, all the records that they had before them indicated that Mr. Reeves functions in the borderline range of intelligence, which is low intelligence, and they presented that testimony to the jury. And the court must realize that this case was tried 4 years before Atkins was decided, and so they wouldn't have wanted to present an expert. They wouldn't have wanted to present the records that all said that he was a low intellectual functioning, and then have an expert come in and say, no, that's not correct. He's actually mentally retarded. So that's a good reason for counsel not to go forward and have a neuropsychological evaluation, because they had all of these records that he functioned in the low range of intelligence, which was the same evidence that they presented through the testimony of Dr. Ronan, that he functioned in the low intellectual functioning range and was not actually intellectually disabled.
Can I just follow up one about, you know, I subscribe to what Justice Sotomayor set out in her dissent for the denial of cert, dissent to the denial of cert, because she said that the Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals decision contravenes the Supreme Court body of law when it said, you know, because Mr. Reeves did not call counsel, he failed to meet his burden. In other words, you can't prove it was not a strategic decision unless you call counsel. And three of the justices pointed out established Supreme Court precedent that says you can prove an effective assistance without calling the trial counsel. So what do you do with that?
Well, I think that you have to look at the totality of the Court of Criminal Appeals opinion, and in fact, they did not base their whole opinion on the fact that counsel did not testify. Just look at the claim concerning the counsel's failure to conduct an adequate investigation into mitigating evidence and failed to hire a mitigation expert. The court noted that when the record reflects that counsel presented mitigating evidence during the penalty phase, as they did here, the question becomes whether counsel's mitigation investigation and counsel's decisions regarding the presentation of mitigated evidence were reasonable. The court noted that Reeves presented no evidence at the Rule 32 hearing regarding what mitigation evidence his attorneys conducted because Reeves did not call his attorneys to testify at the hearing. But that's not all that they looked at. And the court found that the silent record before the court.
But you agree with me that Supreme Court precedent does not require calling trial counsel in order to make a claim of ineffective assistance. of counsel.
I agree with that, but in this case, that the evidence in this case is that counsel had a strategic reason for doing that, for doing what they did and not calling Dr. Goff, which was that all of the records that they had showed that he functions in the borderline range of functioning, and that's the evidence that they presented as a mitigating circumstance or as mitigating evidence that his low functioning. That's the evidence that they had.
That's your assessment of their strategy. I mean, I don't see anything in the record that shows that counsel made that strategic decision. I mean, what's your best record sites?
There are not any record sites because the attorneys were not called to testify in this case. And so you have to look at what a reasonable attorney would do. And in this case, it was to present his evidence of his low intellectual functioning as a mitigating circumstance, which is exactly what they did through the testimony of Dr. Ronan and the defendant's own mother. And the evidence that they wanted to, I mean, the record evidence that they had, which they produced to the jury, and they wouldn't have wanted to contradict that evidence. And the evidence concerning his low intelligence was strong, that he functioned in the borderline range of intelligence and that he was not, in fact, intellectually disabled. So that's why they did what they did. That's what I would think a reasonable attorney would do in this case, and that's what this court has to look at, is what a reasonable attorney would do in the circumstances, not what the best attorneys would do or what the best lawyering would be, but whether what they did was reasonable. And that's a reasonable assumption from the record, from the record in this case, is that counsel had all of these records that showed that he was borderline and not mentally retarded. And I'd like to now move on, if it's okay with the court, to the evidence the mitigating evidence that was actually presented in this case. This is not true that counsel did not present substantial mitigating evidence. In fact, they did present substantial mitigating evidence, and they did investigate. They obtained Caraway Methodist Medical Center records, the Selma Public Schools records, the Cahaba Mental Health Center, and the Mobile Group Home records. They also obtained assistance from the Alabama Prison Project's Mitigation and Investigation Program and from a criminologist. Contrary to Reeves' argument, counsel investigated mitigation, and they described in detail the evidence that was presented during the penalty phase in opening statement, and then presented the mitigating evidence through three witnesses, Detective Pat Grendel, Marzetta Reeves, the defendant's mother.
Can the state make the argument that all the facts that were presented at the Rule 32 hearing regarding his intellectual functioning and his emotional and physical abuse, his neglect, his exposure, domestic violence, drugs at an early age, childhood alcohol, substance abuse, mother's mental illness, that all of those facts that were presented on post-conviction relief, that Counsel Wiggins had all that information during the penalty phase of Reed's trial?
I don't know the extent of the evidence they had because counsel were not called to testify, but I do know what was actually presented at the penalty phase, and that evidence was very similar in form and substance, if not cumulative, to the evidence that was presented at the Rule 32 hearing.
It seems like there was some mental mitigating evidence presented during the penalty phase, but there was a lot of mental mitigating evidence presented on post-conviction relief that could have made a difference on Mr. Reeves' behalf if it had been presented at the penalty phase of his trial.
Well, Judge, I think there was evidence presented of his mental problems. His mother testified. There were records also that were presented to the jury documenting his going to the mental health center in Selma for several years and getting treatment and trying to get help. He was diagnosed as ADHD, and there was evidence that he was put on medicine for that, but that his mother didn't follow up and didn't give him the medicine that he needed like he needed it. There was evidence that his mother suffered from substance abuse. There was evidence that he didn't have a father growing up. There was evidence that the house that he was raised in was horrible. that they were in a bad neighborhood, that he was able to, when he was away from the family home, do much better, that he lacked structure, guidance, and supervision at his home, that they were roaming the streets, that he and his brother were roaming the streets rather than attending school, that he was in the borderline range of intelligence, that he was in a gang, which was not uncommon for individuals from environments lacking structure at home, and that the lack of structure in his home would have led someone like Reeves to be more susceptible to the gang influence, and that he suffered from adaptive paranoia, that his personality adapted to the dangerous environment to which he was exposed at a young age, which caused him to misread social cues and made establishing close bonds with others difficult, and that his antisocial behavior and borderline intelligence were the result of a combination of his intellectual functioning and his environment. That's the evidence that was presented in this case, and that's substantial mitigating evidence, as the district court found. As this court stated in Ledford, the fact that other witnesses could have been called or other testimony elicited usually proves at most the wholly unremarkable fact that with the luxury of time and the opportunity to focus resources on specific parts of a made record.
Well, the Supreme Court also said in Sears versus Upton in a 2010 case that counsel's effort to present some mitigation evidence, and the Supreme Court uses the word some, and it says does not, quote, foreclose an inquiry into whether a facially deficient mitigation investigation, close quote, prejudice the defendant.
And Judge, I don't disagree with that, but in this case, the attorneys for Mr. Reeves presented more than some. They presented substantial mitigating evidence that the state courts found was substantial and that the district court agreed with. I don't think there's enough here for you to find that what the state courts did was an unreasonable application of Sears or Strickland or any other Supreme Court authority, that they presented substantial mitigating evidence in this case. There was a question asked about when Dr. Ronan conducted her evaluation of Mr. Reeves, and it was done on June 3rd of 1997, and she wrote her report on June 26th of 1997. And I'd just like to conclude my argument by saying the state respectfully requests that this court affirm the district court's judgment denying Reeves' claim that he's intellectually disabled and his ineffective assistance of counsel claims.
Right.
Before you finish, could you answer one more question for me? It's a record-based question. You just gave us the dates for Dr. Ronan's evaluation of Mr. Reeves. When was that, if you know, when compared to the request made for funds by Mr. Reeves' lawyers?
Judge, I believe the request for funds was after the report was done. It's not clear in the record when the attorneys actually received the report. It appears that the court received the report sometime in June, but there's nothing in the record as to when the attorneys actually received the report from Dr. Ronan that I'm aware of. I have looked through the record, and I was not able to determine when the attorneys actually received that. Now, the new attorney, Mr. Goggins, when he came in, he did, after the judge had granted the funds, he did ask for all the records from Taylor Horton Secure Medical Facility, which is where Dr. Ronan's evaluation was conducted.
All right. Thank you very much.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hughes.
Thank you, Judge.
And Mr. Friedman, you've reserved some time for rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to start with the record question that was just asked. And I happen to have the luxury of time. the second request for funds was made in September of 1997. So it was after Dr. Ronan completed her report, I believe, based on what Ms. Hughes has said here. So I think that clears that up. With respect to the ineffective assistance of, of counsel claim, I want to make three points, I think. First, we perfectly accept that it is not the state's burden to establish why counsel didn't contact Dr. Goff, but the evidence here is simply not silent, as my colleague repeatedly said before this court. We have trial counsel going on the record multiple times about the need to hire an expert for mitigation purposes, about the fact that they were in possession of material that, quote, would be exceptionally pertinent at the penalty phase of the proceeding, and they admitted that they were unable to compile this information and present it in a way that would be meaningful for the jury. Now, in response to one of the court's questions, Ms. Hughes proffered a justification for why counsel may have acted reasonably. And what Strickland does is it establishes a presumption that's rebuttable. And so I think it's appropriate for this court to assume that it was a strategic choice. And if we take Ms. Hughes' proper justification, which is that they had Dr. Ronan's report and it was reasonable to rely on that, well, first of all, that seems to be inconsistent with the way the timing happened here. It looks like the report was prepared before they made the request to hire Dr. Goff. But putting that issue to the side, if that's the justification, if the justification of trial counsel was they had Dr. Ronan's report and it was reasonable to rely on her rather than hire Dr. Goff, then they would have at least contacted Dr. Ronan before she testified. And they didn't. The evidence is clear that they never contacted Dr. Ronan. So that proper justification just is inconsistent with the known facts in this case. And that's exactly why this record isn't silent. We know that justification doesn't work. And so what we're left with is the presumption of reasonableness and the state completely unable to even speculate about what justification trial counsel had for not contacting Dr. Goff. And based on all the other evidence in the record, including trial counsel's repeated statements, their performance was plainly deficient under Strickland.
Counsel, you have 2 minutes remaining.
Thank you. The other issue I want to address is the point that came up earlier. Ms. Hughes and the state has argued to this court that the fact that trial counsel presented some mitigating evidence, and Ms. Hughes calls it a lot of mitigating evidence. I disagree with that, but I don't think that distinction matters. But it's clearly not a bar to this court finding an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. And I also want to say that Ms. Hughes and the state's analysis of the prejudice prong doesn't really appreciate the Supreme Court's repeated precedent on this issue, which requires this court to reweigh the mitigating and the aggregating evidence in determining whether there was prejudice. And so it isn't just a question of whether there was some evidence presented. The question is whether the additional mitigating evidence that was presented at the Rule 32 proceeding when weighed against the aggregating offenses could have changed the vote of at least one juror. That's the question for this court, and that was the question that the Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals never answered because they held the trial counsel's testimony was required under Strickland, and therefore there was absolutely no need to reach the prejudice prong. And on that last point, Your Honors, what I'll say is it wasn't exactly clear from Ms. Hughes' argument, but AEDPA certainly does not apply to the prejudice prong in this case. The review would be de novo, assuming that this court found that there was deficient performance. And based on the very low bar for Strickland prejudice, which requires just a reasonable probability, and in this case, a reasonable probability that one juror would have changed their vote, there was clearly prejudice here. And with that, unless the court has any further questions, we respectfully ask that the court reverse the judgment and grant Reeves' petition for a writ of habeas corpus.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Friedman, and thank you, Ms. Hughes. The case was well argued on both sides. And the court is adjourned.